This presentation on apologetics and worldview by Dr. Paul Hennebury of TELUS Theological Ministries is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. It is our prayer that this presentation will deepen your understanding of the Bible, resulting in an improved ability to share your faith with others. Now let's begin our time with Dr. Hennebury.
I showed you this book last week, What's Your Worldview? By James Anna Anderson. I would recommend strongly you buy this book, particularly if you've got teenagers or you work with kids. Buy this book, What's Your Worldview? This guy's very smart and he's right on when it comes to the issues that need to be addressed. Anderson defines a worldview as, quote, an all-encompassing perspective on everything that exists and matters to us. An all-encompassing perspective on everything that exists and matters to us. Does that sound like Jesus died on the cross? Just believe in him and you'll be saved? No, it doesn't, does it? Okay, we have really, you know, reduced Christianity down to a part of Christianity. Sure, a very important part, but just a part. And the problem is with that, is that, if I can kind of illustrate it a little bit here, I'm a terrible drawer, okay? Really bad. I hope these are permanent. What they're doing on here, I'm not sure. Oh, there we are. Thank you. All right. Not permanent. Right. That's better. So you have the cross, okay? And you're supposed to believe on the cross and you're supposed to believe in the resurrection. Okay? And if you believe that Jesus died for your sins, took your punishment, and that God's justice is satisfied in what he did, it's satisfied as far as you're concerned, you have everlasting life. You have to believe that he rose again. Otherwise, you know what, you won't have any life to everlastingly go to. But if we're just talking about this and then we're thanking God all the time for this, do you see? This is a very rarefied and reductionistic way of looking at Christianity. So, you know, what about things like this? Science. You can't read my writing. That's a C. Yeah, oh, it's the glare, is it? I'm sorry. Well, let me go over here and give them the glare. Although we can't go into all of this, what about economics? Or politics? Or business? Are the Christian ways of doing those things? There should be. Isn't Christianity or a Christian worldview to do with everything and everything that matters to us? That means your Christianity will encroach, if it's a rounded Christianity, it will encroach on everything that you do. You see, it will guide and have something to say about everything that you do. Many people, as we've seen, you know, they go to church, they do their thing at church, they go home and they go to, you know, they turn the TV on and so on. Nothing wrong with TV, and, you know, I'm not against it. Then they go to work and they do their thing out in the world. And they think, well, Christianity's got nothing to do with what I do. You know, I'm an engineer. What's that got to do? What's Christianity got to do with that? It's got everything to do with that. According to Paul, you're supposed to do everything to the glory of God, whether you eat or drink or work, I guess, which you do for much longer than you're eating and drinking. Do all to the glory of God. Or don't do it to the glory of God. That's your choice. But that will depend on your Christian worldview, or your worldview, won't it? So then what we did is that we defined a few terms that we'll keep coming back to. One of them is naturalism. And you guys that weren't here, if you'll look at the videos next week, but or that we did. But I'll just repeat it. The belief that all that exists is composed of matter in motion. Basically, everything's physical. Everything's material. It doesn't matter how small it is and how impermanent it is. It's basically part of the physical space-time universe. Okay? If it can be measured, if it has some kind of existence, then it's material. So that's from quarks and mesons up to galaxies. Were you going to ask a question? Yes. Yes.
Can you account for the spirit within that definition, not naturalism?
No, because naturalism rules out the spirit. Yeah. But that's a belief. It's a dominating belief that's out there. In fact, it's the dominant belief in the Western world, in the university, for example. You might say mind from matter is the belief of naturalism. Mind comes from matter. And your mind, your consciousness, your memories, your hopes, your individuality, according to this worldview, is just down to the firing of neurons in your brain. It's completely physical. And we'll be coming back to this because it is such a dominant worldview that we need to hit this hard. We need to really understand what this is about, and we need to see how utterly irrational that view is. But you meet it everywhere. Then a supernaturalism. Supernaturalism is not the belief in ghosts and things that go bump in the night, although of course it can be that. But supernaturalism is the view that the universe and all things material depend upon and are understandable through immaterial realities, especially God. So, supernaturalism, the invisible spiritual realm, supports the natural physical realm. Okay? You can only really understand and comprehend the physical realm if you believe in the supernatural realm. Super just means above. Okay? Something more than the natural realm. Or matter comes from mind. Mind is immaterial, of course, in that view, isn't it? Whose mind? God's mind. God's mind. Matter comes from mind. And then, did I define secularism last week? Secularism's important to understand secularism. That's what we're surrounded with in the post-Christian culture. Secularism is basically the belief that any spiritual preferences or opinions are for the individuals who hold them and have no place in the public square, because they are not anchored in reality. Okay? You can be a Christian, just don't bring your Christianity to work. You can be a whatever you want, Wiccan. Okay, but that has nothing to do with what you do in your day job. Okay, so you push out the realm of belief, generally, you push that out into just the personal, private choice of the individual. And you can see how that has seeped into the church. Okay? I'm a Christian. That's just what I am. That's my private, personal view. Well, guys, you don't boil down Christianity to the level of, you know, the choice of clothes or the choice of food, what you personally like. You must never communicate the Christian worldview in that way. We believe the Christian worldview because it's the truth. Because it's the truth, capital T, for no other reason. If you don't think it's the truth, then for goodness sake, don't believe it. Well, you don't believe it, actually, if you don't think it's the truth. So secularism is a, like, don't bring your religion into, you know, society. Secularism, of course, is a religion. Secularism is the view that everybody else's view, apart from really atheistic humanism, needs to be pushed to the market margins. But as a number of philosophers have said, and in fact humanists themselves have said, humanism is a religion. It has all of the marks of a religion. Okay, it has people that they go to secular altars. You know what a secular church is? A mall. A shopping mall. Shopping malls are built on the, as worship places. Did you know that? They're built for you to go in, not go out of. They pull you into a center. They have logos and so on of things that you are to believe and trust in. Very consciously they've been built, okay, to bring you into it and keep you in it. One of the worst examples is IKEA. I mean, once you're in that place, you can never find your way out of it, can you? But yet, it's an interesting, it's a secular replacement. And the people that design shopping malls looked at churches and cathedrals to see how they were built in order to build their shopping malls. Don't think that anything's neutral, folks. Nothing is neutral in this life. Nothing. Everything has a message. And then finally, in this just this little review, I gave you this quotation from Scott Oliphant. We are to think about and live in the world according to what it really is, not according to how it might at times appear to us. So you've got to, and I've got to decide what this world, what reality really is. When we're dealing with apologetics, when we're dealing with faith, when we're dealing with worldview, we're dealing with reality. With a capital R and underlined and block capitals and all the rest of it. We're dealing with the way things are. And to the extent that you disagree with reality, you are living a worldview that is unlivable in this world. We'll get to why that is and how people muck through as we go through these lectures. But we're dealing with reality, folks, okay? Do you believe that God is responsible for this reality? Is he responsible for you? Is he responsible for the trees? Is he responsible for the seas and the planets and so on? And what holds them together? And the values that all should bind them together? Is he responsible for those things? Or is reality constructed in each generation? Depending on the fads and the programs and the stars of each particular generation, or every 5 or 10 years, trends coming in or out. Okay, so there's your review. That's what we were doing last week. Now I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 1. If you want to know the heading that I gave to last week's lecture. It's just for myself. I called it the field of vision. Field of vision. This one is called creation. And what it...
creation and what?
I haven't finished. I'm just being slow because I've forgotten the word. Creation and what it encompasses. So you know Genesis chapter 1, okay? Somebody tell me what the first verse of the Bible is. The heavens and the earth. Yes? All right. Did you realize that that is unique? That is a unique statement in ancient literature. There isn't anything like that in ancient literature at all. It is absolutely unique. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it goes through the creation by the word, the fiat of God. For those of you who did the biblical theology course, the first one, you will remember that I put emphasis on the fact that there is a connection, direct connection between God's words and his actions. Okay? God always says what he does, what he says he will do. God says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to create light. Bang, there's light. You see? I'm going to create the flowers and the trees and so on. Bang. You know, there's not a fair with a big Ferris wheel and everything. No, there's flowers and trees that produce after their kind. Just let me read this passage to you, verses 11 and 12 of chapter 1, Genesis. Have you ever wondered this when you've been reading it? Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself and on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Do you think that you could kind of squish that out a little bit? I mean, if you were given that as part of an essay, yes, by somebody, and you were editing it, you might want to edit that down a little bit, yes? It's like you're just repeating yourself. Just say, well, let's do this, and that's what happened. Why stick verse 12 in there? It just repeats verse 11. Well, it's not because Moses fell asleep, you know, while he was writing, okay? Or he wasn't paying attention. It's because he wants us to pay attention. That there is a correspondence between what God thinks, what he says, and then what he does. Let us do this, and then he does exactly what he's said he will do. Do you see? It's not redundant. It's there to tell us that you can track God through his word. And because it's let us, and then he speaks and he does it, it's not just that God's... there's a correlation between what God speaks and what he does. There's a correlation between what God thinks and what he does. That's very important. Everywhere in the Bible where you have God... musing with himself, let us do this. He always does what he's talking to himself about what he'll do. He just does it. Okay? There's no contradiction. There's no nothing that's lost in translation between God's thoughts and God's actions. That's really key. You think, well, that's simple. What are we spending any time on that? Because it's very profound. You know, the most important things are the simple things. They really are. It doesn't mean the simple things are all profound, but it does mean that profound things are simple as far as the idea of that's behind them. So you have this gradation, don't you, from the seas, that, you know, the, basically the big blob, the amorphous mass, and then the land appears out of it. And then you have the dry land appearing, and you have the plants all the way up to the birds and the fishes, and then the land animals, and then man on the sixth day, the second half of the sixth day. What you get is that you get a progression up until you get man, who is made in the image of God. And then man, because he's in the image of God, is spoken to by God directly and given dominion over everything else and a responsibility over what's just been created. Now, what that tells you is that this world was created for us. It's created for us. So if you're a rabid environmentalist here, you're not going to like that because, of course, we're the big plague. We're the big menace on the earth. But in the Christian worldview, the world is created for human beings to govern correctly, which includes the environment, of course, doesn't it? So the ones who should be the best ecologists and environmentalists are Christians. The ones who are going to be the hypocritical ecologists, environmentalists, are the ones who don't have a worldview that supports environmentalism and just have some kind of a ethical agenda because there are certain things that they like and certain things they don't like. And really it comes down to choice very often and the choice of facts. So what you have then is a creation, and let's have a look at some of these things because they're kind of interesting. In the first verse, you have one God. You don't have a bunch of gods. And God is creating everything, the heavens and the earth. Okay? That's called a merism, which means that it involves everything. Okay? And that means before the... Do you want me to write that down?
Yeah,
would you? Yeah. There we are. M-E-R-I-S-M. And it means that God, this God, is before all things. He doesn't come out of anywhere. He isn't created. He's just there, and everything comes from him. Everything physical, everything material comes from him and from his power, from his will. And it says, verse 3, let there be light, and there was light. This is before there's even any orbs in the sky to give light. That is very unique too. When the orbs are made on the fourth day, it's actually after the grass has been made and the trees have been made, which means if it's 1,000 years long, then they would have died, surely, before the sun came out. But it says here in verse 14, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth, and it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and he made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light to the earth. Why didn't he call them sun and the moon? You ever notice that? Why didn't he name them? And we'll go into why. No,
it's a human word?
No, but I think you're getting somewhere with that. But just notice he doesn't name them. when we get into pagan accounts and so on, you'll see why that's important. Notice verse 16, he made the stars also. It's like the postscript, you know, like P.S. You know, P.S., yeah, he made the stars. So for somebody, kind of we'll start to go into the ancient creation accounts here. For somebody who's concerned with watching the stars and finding meaning from the stars in astrology, for example, when they come across this saying, well, he made the stars also, that's like, well, it's like that's not important. It's like the whole way that I'm going to guide my life and understand my life and what to do by the stars and using astrology and try to predict, you know, the future and so on. It's like the Bible says that's not important. That's quite right. That's deliberate. It's deliberately said that way so that you will not worship the stars. So let me give you a little overview of other worldviews, other ancient accounts, so that you will see how unique the Bible is. And the Bible is unique. I mean, even unbelieving scholars, you know, will say that the Bible is unique in its creation account. So I'm going to read a little bit. This is from me, okay? But I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. But let me just read a little bit from this for you. I can get there. First of all, there are four ancient creation accounts. Four. Not loads. There is the Sumerian king list. There is what's called the Atrahasis epic. You want me to write these down? So I need to put those away. Soon I can see myself picking one of these big fat ones up and start, you know, destroying everything with it. They look so inviting. So you have the Atrahasis epic. That's from Babylonia, Assyria. It's from approximately 1850 BC, maybe a little bit before that. You have the Sumerian king list, which is interesting for other reasons. The kings on the Sumerian king list live for thousands of years. At least the earlier ones do. Then you have what's called the Eridu Genesis. We won't really deal with that one. And then you have the biblical book of Genesis. Okay? If you want to chuck another one in there, which we'll look at, it's the Enuma Elish. You may have heard of that. Which is a Babylonian account that's later than the book of Genesis. It's about 400 years later.
So unlike African mythology where they explain how the zebra came to be, this is explanation of creation that is all of creation, correct?
Yes, okay. But you shouldn't be asking questions right now. Yes. Because I'm going to get into all of this stuff. Okay, so we're not going to go into all of this stuff, and I'm going to give you a taste, okay? But just to let you know where these are. In the Sumerian king list, creation is assumed. It's assumed. Not described. Okay? In the Atrahasis epic, creation is also assumed. Gods create humans, to do their work for them. The Atrahasis epic, this one here. In the Eridu saga, you have creation by the gods from pre-existing matter. In the Genesis creation, of course, you have what's called creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, by one omnipotent eternal God. No creation out of nothing exists outside of the biblical account. The famous Enuma Elish here, which is a Babylonian account, is not really a creation account. This myth relates how Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K, the patron god of Babylon, came to be the king of the gods. Basically what happened is that there were two original gods, kind of inert things, didn't do very much, who gave birth to two others, the parents of Marduk, or if we can call them parents. And they basically that in their, where their offspring rebelled against the original pair, and Marduk led the rebellion. So he had gods in conflict with previous gods. And in particular, the female god, where are we? I'm going to keep these up here. Called Tiamat. I'll write that name up for you. Who was a kind of a monster, water monster, was killed by Marduk and split in two, and half of her was used to make the heavens and half of her was used to make the earth. And then human beings, according to the Enuma Elish, were created from the blood of another god, Kingu. All right? And we were created, so Marduk killed Tiamat. And there was a council, because there's always councils of gods in the ancient accounts. And there was a council of gods saying, yeah, Marduk, because you've killed Tiamat, you are now the head of the gods. And that's what the Enuma Elish was about. How did Marduk get to be number one? So Marduk and the other gods, basically they created human beings as slaves to do their work for them, particularly to feed them. You don't seem to be very impressed by any of this. It's true. Remember what we did last week? If you're going to reject the true God, you're going to have to put something in its place. Well, this is it. This is part of what's being put in its place. Okay? What's another thing? If there's no God at all, then what do you have? You have what? You have nothing, and then you have chaos, and then you out of the chaos, what do you get? Do you get purpose? You see? You don't have anything. Do you see? And of course, we're going to go in a lot more into detail in those things, but I'm just trying to lay this basic foundation for you right now. often, in these ancient accounts, the different gods initially came from the first god by being separated from him. or her. In the Egyptian creation myths, the god Atum, A-T-U-M, made the other gods this way. He himself emerged from the primordial waters. And in all of the ancient accounts, apart from the biblical account, the waters are before everything. Now, you can see that if you are looking for parallels, you can think, oh, well, Genesis talks about waters, and these ancient myths talk about waters, so they must be parallel. And because these ancient ones, well, at least some of them, not the Egyptian ones, but the Atrahasis and so on, because they were written before, which I'll get to in a minute, then obviously Moses or whoever it was who cobbled together Genesis borrowed from it. You see, that's the thinking. It's not very scientific thinking, all right? And they don't stop to think that, hold on, there's a difference here. First of all, there's much more of a logical and detailed view of creation in the Genesis account, which actually makes sense. And these other accounts are kind of contorted and twisted, and they don't make sense. It's like these are degenerative creation accounts. Yes? It's like they're twisted, you know, like the news media twist the truth, you know? I mean, at the end of the day, sometimes what comes out is nothing like, or very little like, what was actually said. And we know that that happens. But in the ancient cosmologies, and that's what the posh word for it, creation stories, there is no creation out of nothing. There is no explanation of where the gods, even the initial gods, came from, apart from somehow emerging out of the chaos, out of the waters. We're not told where the waters came from. Most of these gods are created, like Marduk, and they create human beings in order for the human beings to feed them. By the way, they some accounts, the Babylonian flood account, for example, that's why the flood came. The flood came because human beings were being too noisy on the earth and were annoying the gods, and so they sent the flood. That's the Gilgamesh epic. You may have heard of that. That talks about that. All of these gods worked within the same order. In other words, they weren't outside of it. They didn't transcend creation. They were within creation. That's a very important point that we'll look at. The God of Genesis, in the beginning, God, and then he created. Okay? But that's not what you get in these other accounts. And as I said with Marduk, you know, he was voted king of the gods. Even a god like Marduk is subject to the decrees of councils of gods. And of course, the most famous one that we know of is from Greece, from Mount Olympus, yeah? With Zeus and Hades and the rest of them. So none of the pagan gods is all-powerful, unchanging, all-knowing, or eternal. And you can't have more than one that would be that, do you see? If you have more than one god, then, and they're conflicting with each other, then there is going to be change, and there's going to be growth, and there's going to be, you know, defeat and victory and all the rest of it. There's going to be no stability. But from the outset, the God of Genesis 1 through 3 and the creator gods of ancient Near Eastern pagan culture are utterly different. If you want to know a little bit more about this, and I'm going to quote these, and I don't have time to slow down, okay, so you'll have to get the recording. But according to the Old Testament scholar John H. Walton, quote, the gods make mistakes, misjudgments, and even commit crimes. They can be surprised. So it is clear that they are not to be considered omniscient, that is, all-knowing. They experience uncertainty and confusion and at times make ill-devised decisions. That's in his book, Ancient Near Eastern Thought in the Old Testament. He goes on to say, quote, the gods experience the whole range of human emotions, whether negative or positive. It goes on here, those familiar with the Bible would find it easy to imagine the gods having joy, pride, sorrow, or anger. In the ancient Near East, however, the gods also experienced emotions such as shame and fear. So they're not very impressive creators, are they? Why is the Genesis account so different? Why are they all similar, and they're all from, you know, Mesopotamia in the ancient, and the Middle East? Why is the creation account in Genesis, which is from the same general area, so fundamentally different? One God, no other gods. Astrology is not important. It's worth thinking about, isn't it? Those kind of few verses that introduce the Bible, they are profound. Let's see, let's move on here. Also, I've said that there is a continuity, and that is actually a technical term, there's a continuity between these gods and man and the rest of the universe. They're all within the sphere of the universe, which is why in ancient Greece, you know, they were all up on Mount Olympus, which you could see from Athens. And that you could build temples for them because they would be in the temples, or at least in the idols that would be in the temples, yes? You can't do that with the biblical God. In all of these ancient accounts, you have man. And then you had the gods who reigned over man, often capriciously, but they were just like bigger men. They really were. With all of the passions, all of the attitudes, all of the stupidity of the men that they created. And this was a continuum. You know, often some of the men could rise to godhood. Some of them were made gods, like Hercules and so on. So there's no distinction between the divine, do you see, and the human. That's what's called continuity. Now, why is that important to know? Well, in every worldview, apart from the biblical worldview, and those that are really heretical offspins of it, you have this continuity. Just think about folk religion and witchcraft and druidism and so on. Okay, why do they cast spells? Why are spells important? Why do they do astrology? Because they believe that what happens up there has direct physical impact of what can happen down here, and that they can influence it by chanting the right spells or having the right power over certain forces. up there, yes? There's a continuity between us and the elements. You have that in Hinduism, you know, we are the tree, everything's one, basic pantheism. You have it in evolutionism, naturalism, everything's nature, everything's one, everything's material. That's why Richard Dawkins can't understand the concept of God, because God must be material. He must be inside, you see? The natural realm, there must be a continuity. That's why he must be very, very complex. Because he's created lots of complex physical things. So he must be even more complex. That's his great argument in the God delusion. His problem is, as even some better advised atheists have said, he doesn't understand the concept of God, the Christian concept of God. Anyway, there's more to say there, but we can move on. That's a basic introduction to these ancient myths. Oh, I will just cite a little bit from this book here, though. If you want a good book, I don't know if this is still in print, but if you want a good little book that you can read and it's not technical, like some of these books are pretty technical, Why the Bible is Number One. It's an interesting title, by Kenny Barfield. This is a very interesting book. It's worth getting. He doesn't always document the way an academic should document. For example, when he quotes the Quran, he quotes the page number. When you quote the Quran, you don't quote the page number, you quote the surah. Okay, it's like the Bible, you don't quote the page number of the Bible, you quote chapter and verse, don't you? Okay, so there are a few problems that way. But then there's lots of good information here. Here's an example for you. Let's see. Where did I say it was? He says this, the Enuma Elish begins at a point when nothing was in existence except Apsu, the primeval sweet water ocean, and Tiamat, the salt water ocean, and their son Mumu, the clouds. From these sources were produced numerous gods and goddesses who eventually began to argue. A war ensued, during which both Apsu and Tiamat were slain. The body of Tiamat was cut into parts and used to create the universe. Half of the corpse was the sky and the other half was the earth. Mankind was made from the blood that flowed from the severed arteries of another god, Kingu, just like I've told you. Can you see in this that you have a belief in the eternity of matter? What's the matter? The matter is the seas, the primordial oceans, out of which the first two gods arose. They arose out of stuff, do you see? So these ancients believed in the eternity of matter. In the Bible, matter is created. That's an astonishing reversal. What about in modern naturalism? Well, we know from the laws of thermodynamics, especially the second law, that, you know, matter is always devolving its energy. Okay, there's only so much energy that can be used up with matter, and then it all comes down to a minimum of zero entropy, basically. You can't use it again. So matter goes downhill as far as its function is concerned. But you have to believe in the eternity of matter if you're a naturalist, because matter's all there is. I mean, you're committed to it. You know, that's the definition. The definition is we believe that everything comes from natural causes. And even when you have these guys like Stephen Hawking, or you have, what's this guy's name? Lawrence Krauss, who wrote a book, The Universe Out of Nothing. Nothing wasn't nothing. Nothing was quarks and mesons and bosons and all these things, okay? It was stuff, and it has to be stuff if you have that worldview. So you have to believe in the eternity of matter. This is a very strong foundation, okay, to hold on to when you're dealing with unbelief. Their beginning understanding of where everything came about and how everything got together the way it did, that makes no sense whatsoever. Actually, what they do is that they have to ship in Christian assumptions. They have to borrow from the Christian worldview in order to make sense of reality. And we're going to see that much, much more as we go through here. They won't say they're doing that, but they have to do that in order to make sense of reality, because Christianity is the only thing that does make sense of reality. Who believes nowadays that we were created from the god Kingu, from his blood? They've thrown off that explanation, but they've got another daft one, that we all came from some little warm pond, as Darwin said. And a collision of, you know, different neutrinos and molecules and so on, whatever, in that pond. No, not even molecules. Molecules came from that. All right, moving on. Another thing that we find here in Genesis is a personal connection between God and what he's made. He creates purposefully, we've seen that. He creates teleologically, in other words, there's a plan up to a point, which is the creation of man, and then he gives man dominion, man or woman, dominion over what he's made, and he talks to them. In creation, the biblical doctrine of creation, the reason that we fit in creation, the reason that we open our eyes and we are wowed by creation, whether it be a flower or a sunset, you know, the different sounds and sights that we see around us, the reason that we go and explore it is because we're made for it. We're adapted in creational terms to do that. That's what we're made for. And we're made to do that as persons relating to a personal God. So that our life within the world is a very personal life. Not just for ourselves and the people that we love, but for the Creator himself. We are made to have that personal relationship with the Creator of everything. Do you see that? If you believe that everything comes from matter and motion, the world is impersonal. Do you see? Again, very big difference between the two worldviews. One of them is a personal creation. That's why there's order, and that's why we search for order. One of them is impersonal and chaotic. That can't explain order or why we search for order. Very, very different starting points. Go to Psalm 19, if you will. You all know this. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And it goes in poetic language to talk about a tabernacle for the sun and so on. But these verses are telling us that the universe is communicative. It's intentional. It's made with the intent of us finding things out. It speaks to us. Why does it do that? Why do the heavens declare the glory of God? And we'll go into how that's the case. But even if you're not familiar with the anthropic principle or any of that stuff, you should know at least that you, when you see a sunset, go, wow, and a cow right next to you on the same field goes, moo. He's not interested. He's not moved. No pun intended. You are transfixed, aren't you? Why? Because it communicates to you. It communicates something to you. So much so that you might want to take a photograph so you can have a memory of it. You might want to write about it. You might even, if you're that way inclined, write a poem or paint a picture of it. What's going on? It communicates something, and you're communicating, even if it's to yourself or others, what that impression was. That's the glory of God that is being communicated to you. And you're reflecting it in some way in your communication back, in your efforts back. Even if it's just saying, wow, or come up and see this. The firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, not literal speech, this is poetry. But it is saying that it communicates something that's legible, intelligible, that speaks to us. And night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language nowhere on the earth where their voice is not heard. That means that anyone in the world has access to this revelation. Okay, go to Romans 1. We have to do this foundational work before we can really start to do the kind of critiques that we need to do a little later in the course. Romans chapter 1. From verse 18 to verse 32, you have one of the most impressive passages which delineates a Christian worldview and why people reject the Christian worldview. Just before this, he's talked about the gospel, and he's talked about a certain kind of revelation that the gospel is. Verse 17 says, in it, that is the gospel of Christ, the righteousness of God is, what's that next word? Revealed. Do you see that? So righteousness is revealed through the gospel. There's something else revealed. Also, verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. That word for suppress means to hold down, to push down, or even to imprison. And as many people have pointed out, it's like a water polo ball that you push down, you press down in the water. You actively have to push it down, to suppress it. Yes? What this verse is telling us is it's telling us that the truth comes to everybody. Not the truth of the gospel, but the truth of God's existence. the truth that they're created beings. It comes to everyone, but they automatically hold it down, suppress it. And they suppress it unrighteously. Do you see that? They don't like the truth. The truth of the fact is that they're created beings. And their creator is communicating to them in what he's made. They don't like that. Why don't they like that? Paul goes on, he says, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, maybe the pangs of conscience, their ability to create, to reflect on things, their intentionality, their ability to point, to conceive of things in here and then make them out there in extended space. It's manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Well, Psalm 19, God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his, that's God's, invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made in the physical realm. The invisibility of God, his, because he's a spirit, his spiritual existence and the kind of God that he is can be understood by what we see in the created world, the physical world. Do you see that? Understood by who? Not the cow. Okay? Not the monkey swinging from the tree. By human beings made in God's image. Understood by us. We're the ones who seek to understand. We're the ones who actually cannot evade God's revelation. It comes to us, we filter it, and straight away we suppress it in unrighteousness. That's what it's saying. Even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. That's the end of verse 20. When it says without excuse, it means without an apologetic. The word is an apologia. Without an apologetic. Without a defense. A person who rejects the revelation of God in them and all around them is without excuse. If they're without excuse, they will be judged by God for the rejection of the truth. Do you see that? They won't be judged by God for the rejection of the gospel if they've never heard the gospel. But Paul's not talking about the gospel here. He's talking about the revelation that God has given all around us and within us. And if they reject that, they're guilty. So what happens to the Kalahari Bushman who's never heard the gospel? He is condemned for rejecting not the gospel, but what's called general revelation. Do you see that? Because he's been suppressing the truth unrighteously. Now, if you suppress the truth about the Creator God, you're going to have to do what we did last week. You're going to have to invent an explanation that doesn't include God. Do you see? And so he goes on, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, their foolish hearts being darkened, professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image. They became futile, verse 21, in their thoughts. Well, folks, if you reject the truth, all you've got left is error. I have a little thing here that I brought along. I knew this would be of some use one day. I was given this. It's kind of an eccentric gift by somebody who owns a machine shop. And it was a Christmas present. And I haven't got the foggiest idea what it is. Some of you might know. But I do know this. It is a very highly precision-made piece of whatever it is. Scrunch it. Just pass it around, if you will, and have a quick look at it. Now, maybe one or two of you guys here might be able to tell me what it is, but I doubt it because you weren't, you know, probably in on what the particular people wanted. Can you sit down, Marty? When they made it. But they wanted it made exactly like that. What do we need in order to understand that?
Blueprint.
We need a blueprint, or we need...
No, it's a purpose.
Well, the blueprint will maybe do that. Or how do we know its purpose?
Instructions.
Instructions, or... Talk to the person who designed it. There we go, you see? If we don't know that, we don't have access to that, or we reject it, then what will we do if we're trying to figure out what it is? We are going to have to invent another explanation for it, aren't we? And then that explanation may be as mundane as it's a paperweight. Or it keeps my door open, or something like that. But if we, you know, are of the kind of mind that we must find out why that was made, and we really want something that's more impressive than, as an explanation, than it's a doorstop, then we're going to try to invent an explanation for it. But our explanation is almost certainly going to be wrong. It might satisfy us. And other people that we tell our explanation to. But if we could talk to the designer, he would say, no, it's not that. It's for this. Do you see? The world and ourselves are something like that. Although we do have the designer that we can go to. And we do have his manual that tells us, at least as much as we need to know, about what these things are and what they do. But often we don't pay attention. Often we reject the designer's explanation. And when we do that, because this world and ourselves are much more interesting than that thing is, we have to invent an explanation for everything. But the explanation is futile. It doesn't really work. It doesn't make sense of things. Do you see? Again, if everything came from the gods, and the gods are always scrapping, and they're killing each other off, and, you know, one god is over the waters, and one god's over the fire, and one god's over heaven, and one god's over the rivers and so on, and one god's over the crops, like Baal in the Old Testament, the Baal cycle. If that's the case, then where do you get a unified understanding of things from? Where do you get a coherent explanation of life from? Where do you get a unified ethics from, or morality? You know, how you should live, how other people should live. Where do you get that from? Where do you get that from if you just believe that we're just material beings and everything is materially created, or not created, but came from cosmic dust? You have to, if you take God out of the way, you have to use your worldview to create a world picture that to you makes sense. But what will you have to do? Maybe I'm going a little bit too quickly here. But one of the things that you're going to be forced to do is that you're going to be forced to create an explanation that isn't an explanation. It sounds good as long as you don't penetrate it too much. It looks good as long as you don't go too deep. So you can say that we're free. You know, we're free to live our lives without looking up to see whether God's going to strike us with a thunderbolt or not. You remember the Gary Larson cartoon where you had God up there, you know, the bearded God, and you had somebody, a sinner down there on earth, and God had his finger hovering over the smite button. Yeah? And that's many people's picture of God. You know, just smite him, you know? God's not there. We got rid of God. So relax, you can live your life. In fact, that was basically what was on the side of buses in London, which Richard Dawkins and co. put on the buses. You know, there's no God, so relax, enjoy your life. Fine if you're Richard Dawkins with loads and loads of money. Not so fine if you are a Hindu at the bottom of the caste rung in Calcutta. But why should you enjoy life? You can't even make sense of life. What, enjoy what? What if you're not interested in superficially enjoying life? What if you want to know something about why you're here and what your purpose is? What if you want to dig a little bit deeper? You'll find nothing but futility. You'll find no answers to the big questions. What is my life? Is there any purpose to my life? Is there any life after death? Why is there so much evil and hurt in the world? Why am I not what I should be? Why isn't the world what it should be? Why is there so much beauty in the world? And how did it come about if it's just by accident? Why is there a world? And why am I here? You know, those kinds of questions that occasionally people ask when they get their head out of the TV or the video games, they think about these important questions and they go to these worldviews, and these worldviews can't answer those questions. What you get as an answer is futility. And the modern one in the West, of course, is that we're just accidents, cosmic accidents. We evolved. And there is no meaning, there's no purpose to our lives whatsoever. Nobody cares. Nobody's watching out for us up there. There is no life after death. It's just what you make it, and depends on the circumstances you were born into and the breaks that you get or don't get. But there's no purpose. And we're telling our kids that, and our kids are committing suicide in droves. Our young people. Because they understand that they're searching. Why? Why am I here? What's the point of this? There's no point to this. If there's no point and I'm not happy right now and I don't see that my chances of being happy are really that great because I'm not that talented or there's too many people, you know, that are ahead of me in the popularity line or are more attractive than me or are more talented than me or whatever, smarter than me. What's the point? I may as well just bow out. But if Christianity is true, if we're created, if there is a creation here, and if God made you in his image, you are intrinsically valuable. Why are you here? You're here because God wants you here. What is the purpose of your life? To go and explore God's world. To be what God wants you to be in this world. To worship your Creator. To have that relationship with your Creator. And to spend eternity with him. Why is there so much evil and trouble in this world? Oh, the Bible's got an answer for that too. But why? Because it's a comprehensive worldview. It explains. Does it answer all of your questions? No. But it does say that we look through a glass darkly right now. But even though we look through a glass darkly, then face to face, we'll know even as we're known. Okay, we'll have loads of answers. Right now, it admits we don't know everything, but we know quite a lot, actually, a lot more than the rest of the world does that rejects the gospel. If we pay attention and think about these things, and we don't reduce this wonderful message down to a soundbite. Here's a quotation from a book. This guy's kind of a liberal, so I don't recommend the book. Terence Fretheim, his name is, God and the World in the Old Testament. But he's onto something here. You know, when these liberals actually pay attention to the Bible, they can come out with some good stuff. And he says, let's see, page 17 and following. Let me just give you a couple of quotations from this. Just think about some of these things, okay? He says this, biblical metaphors for God, with few, if any, exceptions, have relatedness at their very core. Husband, wife, parent, child, teacher, student. Even non-personal metaphors are understood in relational terms. I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. This divine-human relatedness is also evident in the fact that God gives the divine names to Israel. Israel. God, El, Elohim, that's his name. He gives part of his name to his people. Do you see? It's relational. Thereby identifying the divine self as a distinctive member of the community of those who have names. That's theological, technical jargon for saying God wants to be part of a society over that society, but he wants to be part of that society. And so he names us, his people, do you see, with his name. We are in, if we're Christians, we're in the body of Christ. Okay, we're not in the body of X. We're in the body of Christ, who is the Son of God. And we're heirs, joint heirs with him. God is concerned with relationship. He's concerned that we relate correctly with him and we relate correctly with the world and we relate correctly with each other. But notice this idea of naming. In the ancient world, when you named something, you did it because you had authority over it. Okay, so the parents would name their kids. You had authority over it. And they wouldn't just name their kids like Gerald or, you know, Cynthia or whatever, because I like that name. They would think about the characteristics of that individual or their hopes for that individual, and they would give a name that would meet that hope or that characteristic that they saw. And there are many examples of that, of course, in the Old Testament. But you wouldn't just do that with people. You would do it with things, too. Naming things. In the ancient creation myths, naming was connected with function. What they did, okay? So you would give names to things depending on what they did. Which for engineers is probably, you know, That's probably the way you'd do it. But in the biblical account, there's more than just the function that's involved. There's also the idea of relationship, of personality. So you find that man is named Adam, Adam, because that's the name of the ground from which he came. Adam, that's the name for ground, dirt. But he names her woman because she came out of man, yes? But then he also names her, what? Eve, the mother of all living, you see? Which is a much more personal kind of a name. It shows understanding, of, by the way, of who he is, that he understands their significance as our first human parents. God, in Genesis chapter 2, he gets Adam and Eve, puts them in the garden, okay, makes all these trees and these beautiful things around him, and then what does he do? He sees that Adam is alone. Okay? So the very next thing he does is create Eve. No. The very next thing he does is that he brings all of the animals to Adam to see what he would. So the naming, which is a prerogative of God in the first chapter of Genesis, is given over by God to man. He has authority. He's been given dominion, you see. So God allows man to name, and whatever he named them, that's what it was called. But while he was naming them and categorizing them and thinking about them and doing science, something else dawned on him. Because that's what we're like. Okay, we're not just one track, even, you know, people like me that tend to be kind of one track, but we're not always one track people. You know, we can be doing something and then something can spring into our minds because of what we're doing. And that's what happened with Adam. While he was thinking about what to call these pairs, it dawned on him that he was alone. That's what God wanted him to learn. God could have said, hey, by the way, everyone else has got a partner but you. But he didn't do that. He let Adam learn it while he was doing something else. That shows us, again, you see, that the biblical worldview involves us working and exploring and cogitating, thinking about things, reflecting on things, finding connections between things. So Adam does that, realizes it alone, and then God, now Adam has realized, then God creates the woman and brings her to him. Again, brings her to him, very personal. Not just him walking around in the garden, and one of these days, you know, one day he rounds a tree and there she is. But rather, God makes her and then brings her to him. It's God, man, and woman in that personal relationship. Very important that we understand, therefore, that creation, which is creation out of nothing, with a purpose, man is the top of that creation, and creation is personal, and it's relational. You go out there this evening and understand when you step out there that although the trees are inanimate, don't think I'm teaching any kind of pantheism or something, you know, here. The trees are inanimate. The insects are not living like you're living. The sun is not a person, but it's personal, because a person upholds it all, and a person has made it all, and has made it all for you. That's a pretty comprehensive worldview, I'd say. I wouldn't want to give that one up. Not for we all came out of accidental stardust, or that, you know, human beings came about as, you know, some of these guys, Francis Crick, thought that aliens came and, you know, just spored the planet with life, which kind of begs the question a little bit, where did they come from, you know? But it gives things meaning, gives things purpose. All right, moving on here. I noted that in Genesis chapter 1, the orbs were not named. It's just he created this light and he created that light to rule the day and the night. Why didn't it say sun and moon? I think one of the main reasons is that they weren't, in not naming them, you see, they still functioned. They did what God wanted them to do. But there was absolutely no chance that anybody who believed that creation account in Genesis would worship the sun or the moon, or the stars, or would think that their lives are governed by them, because they are given fairly short shrift. They were not even created first. They are slaves of the Creator, who will name them later on when he's good and ready. They're not even the originators of light. The sun isn't the originator of light. God created light without the sun. This has what's called a polemical intent. This is directly addressed against the pagan worldviews, which did name the sun, Shamash in the Egyptian worldviews. And Shamash, as Shamash was rising, he was striving against the other gods, do you see, to get preeminence in the sky, and then would lose his power in the evening. But they would worship Shamash, and they thought if it was too cloudy or anything, they could worship Shamash to make sure that Shamash had more power, so the sun could shine and their crops could grow. Or Baal, the god of thunder, so that the thunder would come, the storm would come. Then do you see the continuity between the two? We can affect things up there. Can we affect God? Not like that, can we? Okay, not like that at all. There's not a continuity between us and God. The continuity that's involved is a continuity of created things, but God is not within creation. He's not a created thing, not like these other gods were. So Genesis, even though it seems to be simple, what it's saying to us is that don't bother worshipping the sun, don't bother worshipping the moon like all of the ancients did. Don't invent a bunch of gods, none of them being godlike, really. Don't think that God inhabits the same universe and is made of the same stuff as everything else. That is unique, again, unique in ancient literature and in world literature. One atheist in England, actually, by the name of Paul Baird, he wanted to debate me about the God of the Bible, or about the existence of God. And I said, I'm not really interested in debating. It doesn't really go anywhere. But you know, where would you lead off? And he said, well, let's pretend that there was a God. And so I wrote back and said, well, what's he like? And he wrote back a few things. Well, he was just a God. He could do things. He had power and so on. I said, well, that's not the God I'm talking about. I'm not talking about Zeus or Odin or Thor. You know, I'm talking about the Creator God. That's the one. I don't believe in that bunch. So if you want to debate whether one of those exists, no. I'll agree with you. But if you want to debate the triune God of the Bible, then we need to define him as eternal, as unchangeable, as all-powerful, as all-knowing, as triune, trinitarian, so that he's societal. And he didn't want to debate that God. He didn't want to debate an all-knowing, powerful, transcendent God. He just wanted to debate a God. Well, you see, that's what they do, don't they? Richard Dawkins and the rest, they think that the God of the Bible is like the Tooth Fairy or the Flying Spaghetti Monster, don't they? But the Flying Spaghetti Monster is not all-powerful and not eternal and not transcendent. So I don't believe in a Flying Spaghetti Monster. And somebody who goes about with a colander on their head is an idiot. I don't believe that. Why are you wearing a colander on your head and making a statement about something I don't believe in? Take it off your head, open the Bible and read it. Then you won't have a colander on your head anymore. And you won't think you're so smart, maybe, for having a colander on your head. This is a purposeful creation, and the kind of God that God is, we would expect him to have an orderly, purposeful, relational creation, and that's what we have. But it has problems, doesn't it? And we have problems. It's fallen. Part of the Christian worldview is, if it's going to be comprehensive, it has to address why things aren't the way they ought to be. Why we grow old and die. Why there's disease. Why is there pain and suffering? Why is there evil in the world? Why are there natural evils in the world? You know, the tsunami comes in, wipes out thousands and thousands of people. Why? Because they're necessarily bad? Actually, that's what some Christians taught. Jesus was asked in Luke 13, the Tower of Siloam fell on some people. And the disciples wanted to know, were they more guilty? Is that why that happened to them? And Jesus said, no. He didn't answer the question, but he said that basically these things happen. Okay, make sure that you repent, make sure that you are correctly related to God, because you don't know. These things happen in this world. The man that was born blind is another one, yes. This is the world that we live in. It's called a fallen world, and the Bible explains the fall, which we'll go into a little bit more next week. But Ecclesiastes 7, if you want to turn there quickly, Ecclesiastes 7. the end of the chapter, verse 29, says this: "Truly, this only have I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes." Now, obviously, because of the way that that is worded, the "but" at the end there is negative. It's to be interpreted negatively. In other words, it's not God made man upright and they have done wonderful things with their schemes, but they've gone astray by seeking out many schemes, and that's a negative connotation. We're fallen creatures, and we live on a cursed earth. Things are off kilter. Things are not what they should be. Our relationship to God is not what it should be. Things have changed radically. Evil exists because we allowed evil in, or our first parents did. We became evil because of the fall. We became corrupt. Deadness entered us. Some of you know this, so maybe you can answer for me. In chapter 2 of Genesis, we find God planting Eden, and he planted trees there which were pleasant to the eyes and good for food. That's what it says. Chapter 3, the serpent comes in, has a chat with Eve. Eve finds herself in front of the tree, and she's looking at the tree, and she says it's pleasant for the eyes and it's good for food. And it also makes one wise. She added that bit of information. But she's agreeing with God, isn't she? Isn't she agreeing with God? Is there any problem with her sizing and analyzing the tree like that? Is there a problem? Did something happen in her mind, in her thinking, after she'd had that little chin wag with the serpent? Actually, yes. She got herself from under the word of God, and she became an independent arbiter of God's word or Satan's word. Her opinion was brought in, and her opinion could differ with God or agree with God. So the very fact that she agreed with God on two of the things still meant she was in rebellion to God. You can agree with God and be in rebellion to God. Why? Because you're not under his authority. And independence or autonomy is our default setting. This is what we'll end with today. Why is that happening? Let's try this one. Really? Okay. There we go. That's our default setting, folks. You ever wonder why it's so hard for you to obey God? Whether it's so easy for you to drift away? Why you have to, every morning, kind of check yourself and get in line, if you even bother to do that? Why? Why don't you just lockstep march in accordance with God's will? You're saved, aren't you? You got the Holy Spirit within you, don't you? Why is it so hard to be a sanctified, godly, Christ-focused Christian? You know why? Because your default setting is independence from God. You've been redeemed, but you are not glorified, and you still have your sin nature, and your sin nature is independent from God. You've got to watch it, because that means that you can agree with God sometimes and still be in rebellion to God. That means unsaved people can agree with God but be in rebellion to God. The key thing is that they're independent. What does faith do? What does faith do?
It rids you of your independence.
It makes you dependent again. Doesn't it? You can't go to God in your autonomy, your independence, and then exercise faith in Him, because you're not depending on Him. Why would you exercise faith in Him? Your faith is in yourself or in something else. Faith brings you into dependence with God. That's what faith is. Faith is necessary in order for you to be independent. This is why that you cannot please God, Hebrews 11:6, unless you have faith. Because if you don't have faith, you are independent of God in your thinking. So the Christian worldview, you know, people say they characterize faith. Sam Harris has a whole book, The End of Faith, where he never defines faith. But he says faith is like, you know, the opposite of reason. No. It is maybe in his worldview, his crazy Buddhist atheist worldview. But in the biblical worldview that accounts for everything, faith makes perfect sense. We're fallen. We are autonomous. We are tend to go our own ways. What's that hymn? Prone to wander. Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. That's us. Faith is the thing that brings us back to depend on God again. So it's perfectly rational, do you see? It's the cure to our independent spirit, to our rebellion. Finally, then, there's much more here, but I'm going to end with this little quotation, and I want you to think about this. Creation, as sustained by God, possesses order. Would you agree with that? Okay? You can put in purpose in there as well. Now think about this. Which has been reaffirmed in the resurrection of Christ's body.
Can you repeat the quote?
Yes. Creation, as sustained by God, possesses order, which has been reaffirmed in the resurrection of Christ's body. You're thinking, I know. Christ's resurrection is our hope, but it's not our hope to keep on living this life, you know, so that all of us in 1,000 years end up in a huge geriatric ward. You know, it's the resurrection signals that creation's good, that the material world is good, but it's fallen. But it's going to be reaffirmed. It's going to be rejuvenated and glorified. Do you see? Repersonalized. That distance between us and God is going to be closed again. So the resurrection of Jesus Christ is central. No, it's not just a thing that Christians believe. It's central to the Christian worldview and the Christian understanding of what this is. And our hope. It answers those questions of meaning and purpose with an affirmative answer.